listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have an amazing singer-songwriter, Mr. Brian Lawless. How are you, Brian?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. And on such short notice, who can complain?
Hey, you know what? It's funny. I love that you were able to do this because one of my friends plays guitar for Lady Antebellum. And he was supposed to be scheduled tonight. And his mom is ill. And so he texted me right now. So I'm like so happy that you could do this. So, well,
Jason, happy to be here, man. Thank you so much.
Jason, we wish you the best and we'll have you on the show again. But for now, Mr. Brian Lawless, let's start with the very beginning of your career, which was the moment you fell in love with guitar. What was the moment of zen that made you fall in love with music, made you want to play guitar?
I remember being in college. I was with a bunch of my friends and Ooh La La by Faces came on, and I remember sitting there just falling into such a trance that I was like, I need to do this. Like, this is my life's calling. Like, I don't have anything else in the world that I want to do. It was just a magic moment that it'll stick with me forever. It was really something that just utterly changed my life.
And were you in a car? Were you at a party? Were you just like in somebody's living room listening? Like, what was?
We were all just hanging out on like a back stoop, and it just kind of came on a shuffle on a radio, and I was just like, "This is unbelievable!" And I was just blown away. I mean, everything about that song, everything from Ronnie Wood's vocals to the acoustics, everything. I was blown away, and I was like, "I need to do this with my life."
What's so cool too, I think Rod Stewart was in that band and Ronnie Wood together. It's like you see all these legends now, but like you see their early stages of their bands. And then now, you know, Ronnie's with the Stones and Rod's got this huge career. It's just cool when you can trace it back to something like that first band, you know?
Definitely. Especially being Ronnie Wood playing with everybody from Rod Stewart and Faces. He was in the Jeff Beck group for a little bit and then he hopped over to the Stones. And it's just like, dude, what an amazing career of just, how could you complain?
I love that you're way into older music, which is super rare for somebody your age. Were your friends or your circle of friends, were they all into classic rock from their parents? Or like, how did that happen? Because that is really rare. You don't see that.
Growing up, I mean, I fell in love with the Beatles at a really, really young age. I was probably somewhere along like, I want to say fourth grade, but I really only surrounded myself with people who had a good taste in music anyway. But I feel like I kind of had that influence on people where I was like, you have to hear this. And then like, as people hung out with me more and more, they were like, this is like, why haven't I heard this? And it just kind of, I like to be the person that turned everybody on to some good music. And it really is something that I'm proud of. And I think that I kind of had a label for it too, when I was in college. Like, it was just like, he listens to rock, man. It's just how it is. And it's just something I've always kind of carried with me and how it's been ever since.
Well, it's also, I think it's important for songwriters to know where music came from, to be able to write something that kind of follows that evolution. So you can't really write great songs if you don't know where music came from. And I think that's super important, you know? So, so you went down that rabbit hole. Who was the next? You said the Beatles were next. Was there, I know
the
you got
Stones, the Stones. It was probably the Beatles opened the door. Actually, Stevie Van Zandt of Bruce Springsteen said once, the Beatles showed me it was possible. The Beatles showed me how to do it. And the Stones showed me it was possible.
Wow.
So I was one of my favorite quotes ever. Cause it was like, the Beatles were always this untouchable kind of, I could never be that. I mean, even Ozzy Osbourne, RIP Ozzy, has that kind of sentiment towards them. But then when you saw the Stones, you were like, I want to do this. I can do this. I want to be able to do this. So
too, the Stones are still doing it. Like,
yeah,
like it's so like insane that they're 80 and still play, and they're playing with the biggest production. They're playing the biggest world tours. I mean, it's just insane. It's just
selling out arena after arena, like it's still 1985. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I agree. I love that you love that band, because most people in your generation don't really know the Stones. They don't know the B-cuts. They don't know, like, you know, they don't even know some of the hit songs. It's so crazy to me. And it's
true.
It's like when I go to a Stones concert, I don't see a lot of young people there. I see mostly older people. And it's like, I love when I do see younger people listening to them, because I'm like, this music is going to live forever because it's carried on by your generation and the generation after you. That's how it's carried on forever. But it's like, you know, it's weird. Pop music is so immediate. How do you find that? You know, when you love old music like that and you see what's happening in music, do you still gravitate towards what's happening now in music, or do you still kind of like have a reverence for the older classic music?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, the people of today, like your especially your big country singers that are selling out arenas too, there is some star power there. So you do have to appreciate what they do and how they're doing it no matter what. But I think there's just a level of elegance and class that kind of the older generation just kind of carries a little bit. And they really were business end of show business. A lot of these guys showed up and treated it like it was a job and didn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of social ability between everybody, I guess is the right way to put it. It was more like I show up, I play, I leave. And a lot of these acts now, they invite a lot of people. You'll see a lot of celebrities around, and not to say that the older generation didn't have that. It's just become more of a trendier thing now versus the actual music itself. So I would like to say that I still gravitate towards those older bands, and those are my roots. Those are how I learned how to play, how I learned how to write, everything about it. So it's kind of, I stick to them just because it's what I know. And I still have a lot of respect and a lot of love for the people that are doing it now, because they are the ones carrying the torch, and without them, you know, music dies. So with them pushing people to go out and still play, it's kind of, it's a necessity, and I'm glad that they're doing it in the way that they are. But now we're kind of seeing these older bands start to take form again. Everyone's calling for Radiohead to go back on tour. Oasis is selling out arena, and they'll be in LA. Right. But it's waking up a whole new generation to rock and roll music, and it's unbelievable to kind of see this full circle. And I mean, as much as pop and country and pop country we're doing, it's the pendulum swinging back. Guitar music is on its way back, and I'm really happy about it. So,
yeah, I mean, what's really cool is like we went through this stage of like a lot of electronic music and a lot of like computer synthesized music and pop music, and to see it go back to musicians playing instruments and just like being in a band and like kind of like having that thing be what drives people to come see a rock show again. It is exciting, because I think you know this too. It's like when you love the old music, and I love the old music too. I've got, this is my wall of Paul back here. There's I think I told you I met Paul McCartney, and that's the signed ticket stub right there. But like he's above my piano for a reason, because it's like the Beatles are on that pinnacle and the Stones are also on that pinnacle, where it's like they're just they're on the iconic Mount Rushmore of rock and roll. And when I look at music today, it's like, I don't know who that band is. I don't know who's churning out hits like that in the same way that will be the Rolling Stones or the Beatles in 20 years. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like this weird thing that's happening, that I feel like music has changed so much, but it also is starting to come back to bands like that, you know?
Well, I think it's a major culture shift that's kind of happening, because for the last at least 15 to 20 years, it's been a lot of hands-on from labels and suits and executives, where Noel Gallagher even said, had a quote where he said, like, the music industry doesn't want, I mean, he's changing it, but they don't want mavericks anymore. They don't want people that are changing the way that the game is played, where for the last 15 to 20 years, it was played a certain way. You had to be, think, act, dress, feel a certain way. And now that these rock and roll bands are getting an entire generation of kids back on, hey, you can do what you want. You can feel what you want. You can play and sing and say what you want. So it's kind of, again, the pendulum is swinging back where everyone is kind of jumping into the, I like them because they say what they want and do what they want and feel what they want. And it's awesome. I mean, it's liberating in a way that you're having a new generation fall in love with rock and roll all over again.
Right. When was the first time you wrote a song, and is it a song that is in your catalog and you play it live, or was it a throwaway and then it took you some time to get to that song?
It was an absolute throwaway. I'm pretty sure I lit it on fire. It was one of the worst things. I remember lighting it on fire and throwing it in the toilet, and just, I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever read. And it took a long, long time for me to figure out how to write music. It's not something that, you know, you're going to learn in an English class. And sometimes it's not even something you're going to learn in a music class. It's something that, for me personally, it was just a lot of experiences and things that you felt and wanted to say. And it took kind of a lot of figuring out to get to that point.
And what's your writing style? Would you say it's like observational? Is it kind of like you're talking from an autobiographical perspective? Like, how do you write? What's your writing process?
I think I enjoy some kind of mix between my own personal experience while also kind of generalizing and kind of using what anyone would want to feel. If it's heartbreak or longing, how would anyone feel in this kind of situation? And that's, I definitely impart some of my own personal experiences on that. But it's been more, especially as of late, kind of, how would someone else feel in this position too? Or how would everyone feel in this position, especially in a time now where so many people are just kind of floating around lost? You're like trying to herd everybody back together, trying to be like, I feel you. I understand what you're going through. I understand it's not an easy road. And it's been nice to kind of write for other people while also writing for myself in a way.
Well, and it's also, you're in a really cool part of your career where it's like, you know, you're 27, correct? Is that what?
Yes.
I think that's what you told me at coffee. You're in this really cool phase where it's like, you know, you're just trying to get your feet wet. You're trying to get things moving. You're building a fan base. And it's one of the most alive parts of your career. And unfortunately, you know, and I'll say this from experience, you're not in that place where you're enjoying a lot of it right away. Or are you? Because I remember just like the beginning of getting things moving, how much work it took, how many shows I played to 0 people, 2 people, 4 people, 10 people. Like, I remember all of those shows so well. And it's like, now if I ever have those experiences, it's like, it's like comfortable. It's like, whereas in the beginning, it was so uncomfortable. It was like, oh my God, this is so hard to do and build. And then you have these moments where you start seeing people enjoying what you're doing. Like, it's in a very alive part of your career. Tell me what you're going through in some of those aspects of growth, development, and just kind of like understanding, like, it's you against the world and you're taking it on.
For me, I mean, I love a good fight. I do love a good struggle. I do love a good, but I think one of the things that I've become comfortable with is just playing for anybody. It could be 2 people, it could be 4 people, or it could be 100 people. I've done all of the above, and I've tried to put on the same kind of show no matter who it's for. If it's around a campfire with friends, if it's around, I really do enjoy the building blocks of your career, because it's when everybody who's already made it tells you to enjoy it, because you're never going to have that feeling again. So it's
very true.
While it is a demoralizing or struggling, you struggle in some aspects, I think it's kind of, it's nice to stop and smell the roses, because if you're really that confident in what you do, you're like, it's never going to be like this again anyway. So it's kind of something that, it is kind of nice to just enjoy no matter what happens.
Right.
And for me, one of my, I guess, strengths when it comes to performing is I've always been comfortable up there anyway. So it could be for whoever, whenever, or whatever. It's just, as long as I'm getting to do the thing that I love, I mean, I have no complaints, but
right.
it can be frustrating when you are trying to create that kind of exposure and you are trying to, but everything happens with time. It's just, it's a waiting game no matter what. And as long as you do all the right things, I think, you know, good things come. You just have to feel good doing it. So,
well, I'm going to tell you something from the other side, like not like life and death, but I mean, I'm 46. I've gone through a lot. I've played a lot of festivals. I've played small shows and really big shows. And the one thing I will tell you, when you play a show in front of six people, and those six people stay with you and they start coming to more and more shows and it starts to build. When you play in front of 1,000 people and 10,000 people or 5,000 people or 2,000 people and you see those six people there, like they become so valuable to you. And the rest of the people, as much as it's great to see more and more people there, they are not as valuable in your eyes, because it's like you'll look out into a sea of people and you'll recognize the people that were there in the very beginning, and you'll have a moment that nobody else in the room will understand. And that's the part of the career you are not going to know until you get to that side, because it's like that beginning stage is important of finding those people like that are going to follow you all the way to superstardom or whatever it is. And I'm not even saying I've reached superstardom, but I'm saying like when you get to that level, it's those people that are in the beginning that are sticking with you, that are buying your records and sharing the, you know, your music with their friends, that they hold so much valuable. They almost hold so much value as you get to that, you know, those bigger arenas, and you're going to get there. But it's like, it's so hard to see that in the beginning when you're just like playing for, you know, 30 people, 20 people, 15 people, whatever it is. But I've noticed that like it, when you play to the bigger sea of people, it's they're like their faces. But when you see somebody that you know has been there buying your records for years, it's like those people become even more valuable. And those are the people, what's funny, that I end up hooking up with passes to festivals, that I hook up with, you know, backstage passes, whatever it is, because they were there in the beginning. And it's like nobody understands how important that is, more than a songwriter or an artist. And, you know, who is that artist for you that kind of makes you feel inspired to keep writing when you go to see a show?
Oh, that's a tough question. That's why they say you're the best interview in town. My, ooh, who's really pushing that boundary? That's a really tough question. I would have to say, that is a very tough question. As of late, I would still, they just kind of blew up, but I had recently just seen Royal Otis at the Bellwether, and I was like, these are just two kids from Australia that they just have it, man. They just have that magic in a bottle. And when I saw them, I was like, these are two kids that are just going out there and doing it, and they're doing it so, so well that I was like, it's like almost like, it's like when they send a horse out on a track and then they have the horse that's faster than it just so it wants to run a lot faster. After seeing them, I was like, you have to do more. You have to be better. Wow. You have to, I mean, they're great. They're phenomenal. And their musicianship, everything from their writing to their music, everything. I was just like, you have to be better. So, I mean, shout out Royal Otis if you guys ever see this, but they push the boundary hard. I was standing in that crowd stunned.
That's awesome. You know, those shows, I know you feel this, and I know every songwriter feels this when they go see a show. It's like, it's a kick in the gut, and it's also inspirational. There's a great meme, I'm sure you've seen it, where it's like how a musician feels when they go see a show, and it's like a football player dressed up, and he's standing in the arena watching a football game, and it's like, oh my God, that is the perfect analogy, because you want to be up there, you want to be playing, but it's also very inspirational for you to write songs. I remember Chris Martin said he saw Dave Matthews Band and a friend of his took him, and he was just like so kind of like blown away with the band. And then he went home and he wrote Green Eyes about the girl that took him to that show. And that song, like the whole world knows that song from one of their biggest records. And I'm like, that's what I love about music. It's like, you don't know how a musician's going to inspire another musician to write something else that's great from their own great work. And there's nothing that's better. I'm still addicted to that. Like, I still go see shows all the time. And I love that you had that feeling. But did you find that there was also a kick in the gut that you're like, okay, I have to turn this into inspiration, but that there's also that, oh, it hurts to not be up there yourself.
Yeah, I think a part of me did have like some kind of, I don't know if jealousy is the right word, but you're just, you want to be there because you're like, right. you're watching them experience what many musicians, songwriters, singers would deem euphoria. They're up there right. doing the thing. So it's yeah. like, while I did appreciate listening to the, I mean, they're again, phenomenal live. I feel like I'm plugging them on this show and I'm not, but they were absolutely great. And you're just sitting there watching the entire time being like, I wish I could be up there doing that too. I mean, they were having a ball, and it's just something that anyone who's a musician would want to do. It's that feeling of, you know, I'm there living the dream that I have. So I have to do everything I can to do it too.
Well, the reason I bring it up is every musician goes through that. Every musician feels that when they're seeing that. And it's also good for us to see it because it brings in some humility. It brings in some inspiration. It pushes us to keep digging, keep practicing, keep writing. And I think it's an important part of the cycle. You know, it's like I think a lot of musicians that stop going to see music or stop listening to records, they stop being able to produce great music. And you can tell when there's, you know, an input and an output. And if you don't have a constant flow of both, I think that's where you kind of get stalled, you know? So I think a lot of artists, it's important, you know, for all of us to keep, you know, being inspired by other artists, but it's also a tough pill to swallow sometimes. Let's get to your songs. You started making records. How old were you when you made your first recording, album, et cetera?
My first real professional recording was done, I believe, almost 3 years ago now. 2 years ago? 2 years ago now. It was around December, January of 2022 into 2023. It was a cover I wound up doing, Dead Flowers by the Rolling Stones. Shocker.
Great choice. Great cover, by the way. I listened to it. It was very good.
Thank you. It was something that I wasn't expecting to put out first or immediately. It was something that I kind of dwelled on, and I had people who had no frame of reference in the space whatsoever, hip-hop producers, EDM producers. They were all like, this is phenomenal. Like, you have to put this out. So it was kind of eye-opening to kind of see people from different walks of life, genres, everything that were like, this is great, put this out. And I was, my first recording was a cover.
That's awesome. Was it overwhelming to be in the studio at first? Because it is such a like, oh my God, there's so much, there's so many knobs, there's so many sounds, there's a click track if you're playing to a click track. Like, well, you know, it is a little bit of a challenge just to kind of get used to it.
I think I was first mostly in awe because it was like, you're the engine driving the car now. You're the one that needs to make the sounds that sound good for the microphone to pick up. I think it was mostly a natural state being in there. I felt pretty much comfortable, but kind of having that pressure of like, okay, let's see what you have was kind of the big wake-up call that it's like, oh, I'm the one that has to do this. Like, I'm not just listening to my favorite band. I'm not, you know, they wrote the songs and the music and the lyrics, but it's like, now I have to do it. And now not only am I doing it, but there's a tape running. Right. So it was kind of a big surprise off that first recording of just being like, you're the one driving the car, man.
Speaking of driving the car, did you listen to the song when you first got it and just go driving and just listen to it forever? I still do that. I still drive long distances when a record's done and listen to the record like as a whole. It's one of the things where it has to pass that drive test for me to be like, dude, this sounds great. You know, like, do you take your music on a ride like that or any kind of listening binge where you're like so excited to listen to what you produced?
I think the car is the first place I run to. I've been told multiple times that it sounds like I make road trip music in a good way. So I think it's always good to, that's where most people listen to their, you know, their music anyway. So it's kind of good to experience it as a listener and take it for a drive, take it wherever you need to. But I did wind up taking that song down Sunset, and, you know, just it was nice. It was a very good feeling, especially after all these years of trying to get to LA, be here, and then to have one of my favorite songs recorded by myself and be able to cruise down Sunset to it was something that I'll really never forget.
Yeah, I know that. I think I was about your age when I did the exact same thing. It's like that experience is an important experience, especially if you're in LA, you're an artist. There's something about that drive, that boulevard with all the venues and all the studios and everything. And you're listening to something that you created and you're like, okay, I'm a part of whatever this is. I'm a part of it now. And that's the greatest feeling. What song do you want to play first? Let's play something.
Let's do White Line Fever first, just because I like the tape click and I think it's a great kickoff.
All right, let's talk about it afterwards. Here's White Line Fever, is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
It's White Line Fever by Brian Lawless. That you put the tape machine in there. Let's talk about that tape machine for a second. What made you want to put that in there?
It is the first track on the album, and it just felt right. It just felt analog. It felt real. It felt exactly like what the song is meant for. Like I said about the road trip kind of music, it's putting a tape in the tape deck and just feeling what it says. It's just putting those blinders on and just going for a drive and just eventually feeling that, you know, white line fever of just, I don't remember the last 45 minutes of this drive, but here I have been doing it. So I think it's a great metaphor, and it's one of my favorite songs I think I've ever done.
It's awesome. It sounds like very Stones meets the Strokes. I kind of hear that throwback, but I also hear something more modern too in the whole kind of like concept of it. Like I hear both influences. I don't even know if the Strokes are an influence, but the sound.
I do love the Strokes. Big fan. Awesome. Great.
Yeah. So it's kind of sounds like the Rolling Stones meets the Strokes. And those are two of my favorite bands. So it's like,
we will take that.
No, it really is. It's like, you know, it's funny. It's like when I listen to music, I always love hearing things like that. Like I love hearing what an artist, you can hear what they're listening to. And it's like, you can tell you love the Stones from that opening riff and the whole arrangement. It just has that Rolling Stones classic rock band sound. But it also has that like Strokes thing where it's got energy. Because you know the Stones have some laid back kind of like groove.
They do love to hang out in the pocket too much. Yeah. Not too much. Forgive me, Mick and Keith. But they do love to hang out in the pocket. And I think it was really cool to have something upbeat, high tempo that just kicks off an album that's, you know, a nice kick in the face. And I think it really is one of my favorite tracks on that album.
I always go through this, but when you wrote the song and then when you recorded the song, was it faster or slower than how you originally wrote it?
It wound up being a lot faster than I had wrote it. It was originally written in standard tuning, no capos, almost like a country song. And then it just turned into a very high tempo. I think I threw the capo up to set like on 7. The chord changes are different. Everything kind of turned into like, you know, you accidentally wrote a really good rock and roll song. So it originally turned out to be, but you know, country and rock do overlap like that, but it originally was much slower, just a more melancholy feel to it. But I think we made the right decision making it a lot.
And I love that. I love that when songs change tempos from when they were born. And I always find that it's always going to be faster or slower, you know, depending on the song. And sometimes it's like, it very rare do I hear a demo and the tempo is exactly the same. It's usually like if somebody's like, oh, it really needs to feel like this is the tempo, then it's like, okay, it'll stay there. But I love when there's a little bit of a push. Usually that's what I do, is I push the tempo a little bit to give it a little bit more like legs and a little bit more of a feel. But there are times where I'm like, man, I wrote this and I was rushing when I was writing it because I was so excited that let's pull it back and let it just be in this groove of like, oh, it's relaxed. You know what I mean? So
definitely.
I asked that for myself because it's like I constantly am thinking about tempos. Whenever I write a song, when I record it, I'm always thinking, oh, where am I going to put this? Am I putting it where I did the demo close to it, or am I pushing it to give it something, or am I laying it even more back so it has more pocket? It's so hard to kind of like find that right tempo. You know what I mean? And it's like you hear these records that you and I both love and it was recorded at one tempo, and then they'll speed it up in the process. Like they'll play the tape a little bit faster. They do these little like tricks, and it's like, man, that's so crazy that they were doing that back then and somebody was making that decision, because that song may have hit no matter what. And some of these little tricks to make it sound a certain way ended up being what we all know the songs to be. So tempos are like huge for me to like think about, like, where is the tempo when I'm writing a song? How did you come up with like when you were like, okay, I need to push this a little bit? What was that moment when you knew this was the tempo?
I almost kind of did it by accident. I was just kind of messing around just like on the transpositions of all the chords, and everything kind of went from a D major and standard tuning, no capo, of just that kind of country slow burn feel, to where I threw the capo up to 7 and then started playing a G, a D, and an A minor, and it just went off really fast. So it went from these kind of like slow, standard, country chords to just a faster version of it. And it was, I could play it a lot quicker just off of habit. And it was like, this is really cool. Right. I write everything on acoustic that way, just because if you can hear it dry, you can definitely hear it electric. So when I was like, it just was one of those spark moments where I was playing it and I was like, I heard the entire song front to back, and it was really, really cool.
What was the inspiration behind the song too?
I think it was probably just my journey to get to this point when I was starting writing this album. That's the first track. And it was just kind of the idea of the last, I think we started the end of 2024, I want to say. So it just over the last, you know, ever since from COVID to then, it was like 4 years had just blurred by. And it just was that idea of going on a road trip and 5 hours will go by. And then you're like, I can't believe I made it this far. And then one day you wake up, you're in LA doing the one thing that you hoped and prayed for as a kid. And now you're like, it's that drive. I took that drive. I went and did it. I lived the art that I always wanted to. So it was really cool. And I'm, again, this is one of my favorite tracks that I've ever done, just based off of feel, tempo, everything about it. And I hope I get to do something like it again, but I don't even think that's up to me.
So what was the next song? Like, when you went for the next song, did it change after you finished this song?
We pulled all the way back. We went so slow. We slowed everything back down. I think it's track 9, something yet. It just went from, I believe I played it at our show at Hotel Cafe, but it went from that to like, okay, now what's the other side of that coin? What's the other way that you're feeling this and experiencing this, from that fast, I can't believe I'm here, I can't believe, to kind of pulling back in almost in a reflective way, thinking about everything in a more slowed down, deep breath kind of way.
That's cool. I mean, I like the extremes, you know. It's like when you're in a studio, it's like, it's so great to feel extremes in tempo, style, sounds, mixes. It's like all those, you know, things. And I obsess about mixes. I'm sure you did too. How did you know when you had the right mix?
I think after I got goosebumps, I knew it when I was like, there's chills on the back of my neck for how good this sounds, especially from someone who's so critical about what they do. I was like, if I didn't know that this wasn't me, I would go see their show.
Right.
So I sat there and was like, this is the, like, especially this song, it's one song that I was just, in my own head was like, you've outdone yourself a little bit. So
I love that you said that too, because that's exactly what I do. It's like, if a recording doesn't give me goosebumps in the mixing process, then it's not there. So it's like, it just has to give you the feels. And it's, if it doesn't, and it's so hard sometimes, because it could be like a guitar level that's low, or it could be a vocal that's too hot, or a drum that's too dampened, or the EQ of the song, or the reverbs and delays getting mixed. I mean, it's like, I have such a careful balance, but when it does give you that, like, I always tell people, it's like, I learned this from one of my engineers who used to be Van Morrison's guitarist. And he said, you know, get it to 98%, because there's no such thing as 100%. And there's 1,000 ways to get it to 98%. But when you get it to 98%, that's when you're in the ballpark of chills and you know that it's right. Because you can go back and spend more time to get it to another version of 98%, but it'll just be on that same level. So it's like, as soon as you feel something from the song, know that it's in the ballpark and it should be delivered, you know?
It took me a while to learn that too, because when I first, especially again, doing a cover of your Heroes, it was something that I just spent time and time again, just sitting there going over, it's not good enough, it's not good enough, it's not good enough. But when you had other people say like, dude, this is amazing, this is, when you're imparting that feeling on other people, that you were like, I'm already there, I don't know why I'm stressing so much. So it especially when I started writing my own stuff, you kind of had to, I love to play my stuff, just like even the demo versions for other people, just to see their reactions. If someone gets all bright eyed and it's like, it's almost there, it's great. But if it's like, yeah, it's okay, like you want to not be your only guinea pig. And it's something that I've come to learn after, you know, two and a half years of this, of just when you're there, you're there. There's no more pushing the envelope and do something else. You know, it's if you're sitting there worrying about the same song for 6 months, 9 months, or anything over that, you're just wasting your time on other things that could be your biggest hit, but you're too busy focused on something that is already great that you're just trying to push to a level that didn't really even need to go there in the first place.
Right. And you know what's funny too? It's like, I have a very close friend. He's an incredible songwriter. He plays with John Mayer. And he said he spent 3 years on one of his records. He's just a brilliant, brilliant musician. And he said, I've never spent that long on a record. And he said, I don't even know like how to look at that record anymore because I spent so much time getting lost in it. And it's actually my favorite record he's ever done. I tell him that all the time. Like, it's still my favorite record you've done, but I agree that if you spend too much time with it, you will lose that sense of the compass of the project. Like you have no perspective on what it is that you created because you just spent too much time getting lost in it. But sometimes, to his benefit, it may have worked out for him because he made one of the best pieces of music and he made one of the best records that he was able to make. But that he's rare in that. I think most of the time people spend too long on records and then, you know, they spend 2-3 years on a record to put something out and then they don't realize that they could have put more music out there and built more of a catalog and more of a story. But it's easy to just get so obsessed with this stuff because you're like, it's not ready for the public to hear. And I'm like, I don't want to spend more than 10 to 12 months on a record. It's like the record needs to be finished. Like the record will tell you when it's done, but I think it's important to just like get to the point where you're churning it out and just doing it at the highest quality you can and then letting go of it. Because at the end of the day, no matter how much you spend on it or time that you spend on it, it's not yours once you release it. It becomes everybody else's. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So it's really hard to find that barometer. You know, it's good that you have that early.
It's interesting as musicians too, because we're told at an early age, you know, listen to everybody else, listen to everybody else. And we get to these stages where to get to the point where we're at, it was all on us and our own thinking and our own determination, where you're at these stages now. And if you just keep listening to yourself, it's going to go on forever. We're our harshest critics. We're our biggest critics. So it's like, it's weird going from, don't listen to anybody else, just push yourself to a limit. And then it's like, maybe I should see how 5 or 6 people who I trust on their opinion feel about this. Because if I just sit there and kind of hold on to this and hoard all the gold myself, then you're just going to sit there and keep going over how many coins you have. Where if you just show your closest people, what do you think? And someone goes, this is amazing. Just put it out.
Right.
Especially if you trust their word, put it out. But I do see how it's hard as a musician growing up being like, when everyone tells you go do something else and you're like, no, I believe in this. And then now that you're here, it's like, maybe I do need to listen to other people or I'm just going to drown myself in this same piece of art. I mean, Da Vinci stopped painting at a certain point. And if that's the case, like, you know, you got to ask yourself, what are you doing?
Right. Right. And it's also like, you have to create it for the love. That's just got to be a given. But at the same time, that love gets tested when you're making a record. It's like, how many times are you going to listen to that mix? How many times are you going to record that guitar part? How many times are you going to record that vocal? Like, it's like, I go through that with vocals. It's like, man, I know it's good enough, you know, but I could spend a year just on vocals. I could spend just a year on getting the right takes and get it to a detailed level that I just don't have the bandwidth for. I think it would wear me out to spend that much time just on vocals. You know what I mean? It's like, I just feel like I have to make it as good as it can be, let it out into the world, and then make the next thing as good as it can be and let it out into the world. But it's hard because it's like, especially in your stage, it's like all these impressions are important in the beginning. And it's like, you're obsessing over what everybody else's impressions are from what your releases are. So how is that process for you once you finish the recording and you release it? Is it a relief or is it excitement or is it all of the above that you're like, oh my God, I'm excited for the world to hear this. I'm also so happy that it's done. I'm also just worried that it may not get the response or it does get the response. Like, what are those emotions like for you?
Again, another tough question. I think it's definitely a lot of relief. Once something's out, you finally, it feels like everybody else kind of experiences it before you do, even on your release days or anything like that. Everyone says like, congrats on the record, congrats on, and you're just kind of sitting there almost in disbelief that you even did it. That it's like, oh my God, I it's out. I can't believe that I got it out. Like, unbelievable. So it's one of those things that there is a lot of excitement and there is a lot of high energy towards, but at the same time, it is great to take that deep breath and kind of reflect and be like, I can't believe I did it. Now it's time to almost, I mean, I like to jump right onto the next thing that it's out and you're excited for the world to hear it. But as someone who just wants to keep pushing the envelope, you have to kind of just put it in your back pocket. I released it. I have my tracks. I hope everybody likes what they hear. And it is nice to receive that positive feedback where family, friends, you know, even strangers are like, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe that like you did this and it's so good, but you can't let those kinds of things keep you complacent. So it's a little bit of both, but I think the number one thing that I would say is it is good to be reflective towards, because I think it really is the healthiest way to go through it, because it's over. The journey's over in a certain way. It's framed, the picture's done, and then everything is, you just get to appreciate it after the fact. But stressing on who hears it, what hears it, it's almost unhealthy in a certain way, because if it's that good, the world will hear it. And if you're stressing about something like that, it's not going to happen overnight. And it's just good to appreciate the fact that you did do it in the first place.
Well, I don't know if you heard John Batiste's Grammy speech, but he said something really cool. He said, music will find its listeners at the right time. And I'm like, oh, I love that. So it's like, you're going to find records that were made now, 5 years from now. You won't find them.
Of course.
And it's like, they'll hit you. They have this like radar finding you. And I think that's kind of like one of the magical things about what we do. We don't know who it's going to hit and when it's going to hit that person. And that's all we do is just create to make sure that we're creating, you know?
I think that's the beauty of what we do too, because then like you could wake up one day and you could have a hit song on the radio, or someone, you could have a giant fan base, or you could be the thing that's trending on social media, or it's cool to have that possible lottery win at any given moment. And that's why we wake up and do everything that we do, to show the world that any day could be your day. And it's any day in a music studio and in a concert or playing or even a jam with other people is better than any day anywhere else. So you might as well just enjoy the ride while you can. And if it is good enough, people will hear it. You will be heard.
Well, let's play something else. What do you want to play next?
Let's do Lucky Few.
All right, here's Lucky Few by Brian Lawless.
Broken and battered, all weathered and tattered, but the cracks let a little light in. And I hope that you notice by the next moon she's going. Only love can leave a place like this. Nervous and nauseous, I'm shaking and coughing. Oh, them lucky few. Let old things run cold, make new things be bold. Just remember that it's all right here. Let old things run cold, make new. Just remember that it's all right here. Nights are long, the days are long. My feet can't touch the ground. Lights are gone, nobody's home, and we won't make a sound. Nervous and nauseous, just remember that it's all right here.
awesome. Awesome. Do you listen Thank to you. Howie Day or David Gray by chance?
I don't.
Should, because this song is very reminiscent of those both those songwriters. And I'm big fans of both of them. They're just solid, solid songwriters. David Gray, he was I'll send you some links. David Gray was
definitely
the first artist that Dave Matthews signed to his label. And Howie Day kind of came around the John Mayer era. It was like the early 2000s. He's got a great song called Collide. This is very reminiscent of that. And David Gray's a great songwriter. He's awesome. So check him out, because this song is very reminiscent of it. Tell me what the inspiration behind it was.
I actually wrote this song when I was pretty young. I want to say I was probably fresh out of college. Well, I had written pieces of it, and the first couple lines were just something that kind of stuck with me. And as I progressed, it kind of started to form itself. And I pulled all these different pieces of things that I had written, and it wound up just becoming this really cool folk song that was appreciative of life, and that we're all those lucky people that just get to get a chance in this world. And I think it was something that I was just happy while also kind of melancholy, solemn in the same regard. So it was just, you know, it's both sides of that coin. And I thought it was just a really cool idea of you're lucky because not only are things awesome, but they're also not awesome because you're experiencing both of them. So I think it was just something that kind of hit me in the moment, and I'm really happy it did.
That's awesome. Well, it's cool because it's like very conversational. It's very laid back, you know. I'm gonna tell you, you should always do some acoustic songs too, because like I've heard you acoustic, I've heard you produce with a full band, and you got strengths in both. Like, you should let your fans hear that too, because there's something that I love about acoustic music, and a lot of my artists that I love, the Ray LaMontagnes, the Dave Matthews, the John Mayers, the David Grays, they all do that. They have like a full produced version, and then they'll do like an acoustic version, either as like a fan album, like bonus, you know, track or CD or something. And I always love when they do that, because it's like, it's just such a cool way to present music. It's like, even all these songs that you're playing, I think it'd be important for you to also document an acoustic version just to release, you know?
It's something that I've wanted to do. Like I said, I've always just kept pushing the envelope, but it is something that I want to get around to, just because it's how I write most of them. Everything I really do is on acoustic. Electric's kind of just sit and wait till the studio, and everything is kind of that dry bone feel. And if you can do it there, I mean, you can do anything. So I think it is important, and I think it is an interesting way to show your fans or friends or whoever kind of how this idea came about. White Line Fever was written on an acoustic, and so was Lucky Few, but they're two completely different songs, and they were written the same way by the same person. So it's kind of cool to show the range that you have while also saying it all kind of stems from one place.
Well, there's also like a vulnerability that I love with just when it's like an artist, like one of my favorite records that John Mayer's put out is not one of his big hit records. It's the Village Sessions, where it's just like him at Village Studios playing an acoustic guitar, acoustic versions of songs that we all know. And it's killer. I listen to it all the time. And I still listen to his other records, but it's like there's something about that. And Dave Matthews does the same thing, where he'll just release, you know, and it's not necessarily at the same time. And I've kind of done a little bit of that too. Like I went to Sun Studio and did a record of like celebrating a decade of records, and did just a couple like all solo acoustic versions. And I was like, I wish I could do that for every record. Secretly, I wish I would do it for every record, but I'm like you. I'm like, you just got to keep moving forward. But yeah, I think about doing it for every record, because it's always good to have something acoustic as that vulnerable side, because sometimes, and I'm like this, I have like two sides of me. I'm like, I want to hear the rocking tunes, and then like late at night, I kind of want to listen to an acoustic version or an acoustic song, you know?
I've also seen nowadays a lot of people are putting, especially when they do like their deluxe version, or they'll let the demos go on there. They'll show people where it started. I heard a couple of Oasis's on What's the Story, Morning Glory. It's not even like some of the songs that Liam sings, Noel's doing them, just doing the demos to show the rest of the band, this is how we're going to do it. So it's kind of cool to see, like, it's not even at that stage of professional recorded acoustic solo. It's like they just scrap this together, and it's cool. It's really cool to see, especially when most people don't get to see the beginning of that process or hear it. So it's cool to kind of, this is where we started, but this is where we wound up. So I think it's definitely becoming more of a popular trend to show people the acoustic versions, the stripped down versions, the demos, the, because people want to know the backstories to their favorite songs.
Well, let's play something else before we run out of time. What's the last song we're going to play?
We're going to play Storm from my album Moonshine.
Here's Storm by Brian Lawless. That was like the Stones meets the Band, man. Two classic rock bands.
Thank you very much. That's also one of my favorites too. And it's, I would say the coolest part about that song was the acoustic slides that we threw on there to kind of give it that wave in the back. I don't know if there's a band that's ever really kind of had that kind of wavy feel to it, but I'm very proud of that.
So it sounds awesome. Where can people find you if they want to follow your music and find your next shows? You got a lot of stuff coming up. Tell us, where can people find you online?
Everywhere. I'm on all music platforms, streaming platforms, everywhere from YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. I'm pretty easy to find. Brian Lawless on just about everything. I'm on Bands in Town as well, for any of your shows or if you're ever looking at live music, pretty easy to find. Would love anyone to check me out, DM me, let me know what you think, and I appreciate you for listening.
Of course. Well, Brian, we're going to have you back on in about 9 or 10 months, and we want you to keep track of the songs that you played. We're going to showcase more of your music. We want people to come see you play live, and we just wish you nothing but the best, man. On behalf of Sam, myself, go ahead. I see you're saying something.
The Mint, September 19th, Friday in L.A.
That's what I like to hear. Got confirmed, right?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. That's awesome. Well, good. Check out Brian at the Mint, 919, September 19th. And I look forward to playing more shows with Brian. And you can check out his music all over the social platforms, the streaming platforms. And thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, dude.
Thank you so much for having me. I very much appreciate it. And it's an honor to be here. Thank you again.
Of course. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Brian, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Peace, love, and hair grease.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.